They don't like surprise, Fibbon thought. But they are pretty tough when they know what's happening.
Their transport began a long, slow, lazy circuit around the perimeter of the construction site. Fibbon was pondering the white, upturned bowl below when the Kwaku with the pink ruff approached and inclined its head ever so slightly.
"The Great One deigns, does offer favor, and will suggest commonality, complementarity, of goals and aims."
Across the barge, the suzerain of propriety could be seen perched regally on its pedestal. Fibbon wished he could read expressions on a Gubru face.
"What's the old bird got in mind?" he wondered.
Fibbon wasn't entirely sure. He really wanted to know. Galet returned the shallow bow of the Kwaku.
"Please tell your honored patron we will humbly attend his offer."
The suzerain's Galactic Three was stilted and formal, embellished with mincing courtly dance steps. The Vodor translation did not help Fibbon much. He found himself watching Galet rather than the alien, as he tried to follow what the hell they were talking about.
"Allowable revision to ritual of choice of uplift, advisor. Modification made during time of stress by foremost client representatives. If performed truly in best interests of their patron race..."
Galet seemed visibly shaken, looking up at the Gubru. Her lips pressed together in a tight line, and her intertwined fingers were white with tension. When the suzerain stopped chirping, the Vodor continued on for a moment. Then silence closed in around them, leaving only the whistle of passing air and the faint droning of the hover's engines. Galet swallowed. She bowed and seemed to have difficulty finding her voice.
"You can do it,"
Fibbon urged silently. Speech lock could strike any Chim, especially under pressure like this, but he knew he dared not do anything to help her. Galet coughed, swallowed again, and managed to bring forth words.
"Honored Elder, we cannot speak for our patrons, or even for all the Chims on Garth. What you ask is...
The suzerain spoke again, as if her reply had been complete. Or perhaps it simply was not considered impolite for a patron-class being to interrupt a client.
"You have no need not, to answer now,"
the Vodor pronounced as the Gubru chirped and bobbed on its perch.
"Study, learn, consider. The materials you will be given, this opportunity will be to your advantage."
The chirping ceased again, followed by the buzzing Vodor. The suzerain seemed to dismiss them then, simply by closing its eyes. As if at some signal invisible to Fibbon, the pilot of the hover barge banked away from the frenzied activity atop the ravaged hilltop and sent the craft streaking back across the bay, northward, toward Port Helena. Soon the battleship in the harbor, gigantic and imperturbable, fell behind them in its wreath of mist and rainbows. Fibbon and Galet followed the Kwaku to seats at the back of the barge.
"What was all that about?"
Fibbon whispered to her.
"What was the damn thing saying about some sort of ceremony? What does it want us to do?"
"Shh!"
Galet motioned for him to be silent.
"I'll explain later, Fibbon. Right now, please, let me think."
Galet settled into a corner, wrapping her arms around her knees. Absently, she scratched the fur on her left leg. Her eyes were unfocused, and when Fibbon made a gesture, as if to offer to groom her, she did not even respond. She only looked off toward the horizon, as if her mind were very far away. Back in their cell, they found that many changes had been made.
"I guess we passed all those tests,"
Fibbon said, staring at their transformed quarters. The chains had been taken away soon after the suzerain's first visit, that dark night weeks ago. After that occasion, the straw on the floor had been replaced by mattresses, and they had been allowed books. Now, though, that was made to seem Spartan indeed. Plush carpeting had been laid down, and an expensive holo tapestry covered most of one wall. There were such amenities as beds and chairs and a desk, and even a music deck.
"Bribes," Fibbon muttered as he sorted through some of the record cubes. "Hot damn, we've got something they want. Maybe the resistance isn't over. Maybe Athaclena and Robert are stinging them, and they want us to—"
"This hasn't got anything to do with your general, Fibbon," Galet said in a very low voice, barely above a whisper. "Or not much, at least. It's a whole lot bigger than that."
Her expression was tense. All the way back, she had been silent and nervous. At times, Fibbon imagined he could hear wheels turning in her head. Galet motioned for him to follow her to the new hollow wall. At the moment, it was set to depict a three-dimensional scene of abstract shapes and patterns, a seemingly endless vista of glossy cubes, spheres, and pyramids stretching into the infinite distance. She sat cross-legged and twiddled with the controls.
"This is an expensive unit," she said a little louder than necessary. "Let's have some fun and find out what it can do."
As Fibbon sat down beside her, the Euclidean shapes blurred and vanished. The controller clicked under Galet's hand, and a new scene suddenly leaped into place. The wall now seemed to open onto a vast, sandy beach. Clouds filled the sky out to a lowering gray horizon, pregnant with storms. Breakers rolled less than 20 meters away, so realistic that Fibbon's nostrils flared as he tried to catch the salt scent. Galet concentrated on the controls.
"This may be the ticket," he heard her mumble.
The almost perfect beachscape flickered, and in its place there suddenly loomed a wall of leafy green, a jungle scene so near and real that Fibbon almost felt he could leap through and escape into its green mists, as if this were one of those mythical teleportation devices one read of in romantic fiction, and not just a high-quality hollow tapestry. He contemplated the scene Galet had chosen. Fibbon could tell at once that it wasn't a jungle of Garth. The creeper-entwined rainforest was a vibrant, lively, noisy scene, filled with color and variety. Birds cawed, and howler monkeys shrieked.
"Earth, then," he thought,
and wondered if the galaxy would ever let him fulfill his dream of someday seeing the homeworld.
"Not bloody likely, the way things are."
His attention drew back as Galet spoke.
"Just let me adjust this here to make it more realistic."
The sound level rose. Jungle noise burst forth to surround them.
"What is she trying to do?" he wondered.
Suddenly, he noticed something. As Galet twiddled with the volume level, her left hand moved in a crude but eloquent gesture. Fibbon blinked. It was a sign in baby talk, the hand language all infant chims used until the age of 4, when speech finally became useful.
"Grown-ups listening," she said.
Jungle sounds seemed to fill the room, reverberating from the other walls.
"There," she said in a low voice. "Now they can't listen in on us. We can talk frankly." "But—"
Fibbon started to object. Then he saw the gesture again.
"Grown-ups listening."
Once more, his respect for Galet's cleverness grew.
"Of course."
She knew this simple method would not stop snoopers from picking up their every word. But the Gubru and their agents might imagine the Chims foolish enough to think it would.
If the two of them acted as if they believed they were safe from eavesdropping.
Such a tangled web we weave,
Fibbin thought. This was real spy stuff. Fun, in a way. It was also, he knew, dangerous as hell.
The suzerain of propriety has a problem,
Galet told him aloud. Her hands lay still on her lap.
It told you that? But if the Gubru are in trouble, why?
I didn't say the Gubru, although I think that's true as well. I was talking about the suzerain of propriety itself. It's having troubles with its peers. The priest seriously overcommitted itself in a certain matter some time back, and now it seems there's hell to pay over it.
Fibbin just sat there, amazed that the lofty alien lord had deigned to tell an earthworm of a Terran client such things. He wasn't comfortable with the idea. Such confidences were likely to be unhealthy.
What were these overcommitments?
He asked.
Well, for one thing,
Galet went on, scratching her kneecap,
some months ago it insisted that many parties of Talon soldiers and scientists be sent up into the mountains.
What for?
Galet's face took on an expression of severe control.
They were sent searching for Garthlings.
For what?
Fibbin blinked. He started to laugh, then he cut short when he saw the warning flicker in her eyes. The hand scratching her knee curled and turned in a motion that signified caution.
For Garthlings,
she repeated.
Of all the superstitious nonsense, Fibbin thought. Ignorant yellow-card chims use Garthling fables to frighten their children.
It was rich to think of the sophisticated Gubru falling for such tall tales. Galet did not seem to find the idea amusing, though.
You can imagine why the suzerain would be excited, Fibbin, once it had reason to believe Garthlings might exist. Imagine what a fantastic coup it would be for any clan who claimed adoption rights on a pre-sentient race that had survived the Burrali Holocaust. Immediate takeover of Earth's tenancy rights here would be the very least of the consequences.
Fibbin saw her point.
But what in the world made it think, in the first place, that...
It seems our Timbrimi ambassador, Uther Calding, was largely responsible for the suzerain's fixation, Fibbin. You remember that day of the Chancery explosion, when you tried to break into the Timbrimi diplomatic cache?
Fibbin opened his mouth. He closed it again. He tried to think. What kind of game was Galet playing now? The suzerain of propriety obviously knew that he, Fibbin, was the chim who had been sighted ducking through the smoke and stench of fried Gubru clerical workers on the day of the explosion at the one-time Timbrimi embassy. It knew Fibbin was the one who had played a frustrated game of tag with the cash guardian, and who later escaped over a cliff face under the very beaks of a squad of Talon soldiers. Did it know because Galet had told it? If so, had she also told the suzerain about the secret message Fibbin had found in the back of the cache and delivered to Athaclena? He could not ask her these things. The warning look in her eyes kept him silent.
I hope she knows what she's doing, he prayed fervently.
Fibbin felt clammy under his arms. He brushed a bead of sweat from his eyebrow.
Go on, he said in a dry voice.
Your visit invalidated diplomatic immunity and gave the Gubru the excuse they were looking for, to break into the cache. Then the Gubru had what they thought was a real stroke of luck. The cache auto-destruct partially failed. There was evidence inside, Fibbin. Evidence pertaining to private investigations into the Garthling question by the Timbrimi ambassador.
By Uther Calding? But...
And then it hit Fibbin. He stared at Galet, goggle-eyed. Then he doubled over, coughing as he fought not to laugh out loud. Hilarity was like a head of steam in his chest, a force in its own right, barely contained. A sudden, brief spell of speech lock was actually a blessing, as it kept Galet from having to shush him. He coughed some more and slapped his chest.
"Excuse me," he said in a small voice.
The Gubru now believe that the evidence was contrived, a clever ruse, she went on.
No kidding,
Fibbon thought silently.
In addition to faked data, Uther Kalding also arranged to have the planetary library stripped of its uplift files, making it seem to the suzerain as if something was being hidden. It cost the Gubru a lot to find out that Uther Kalding had tricked them. A research-class planetary library was shipped in, for instance, and they lost quite a few scientists and soldiers up in the mountains before they figured it out.
Lost them?
Fibbon sat forward.
Lost how?
Chim irregulars, Galet answered tersely.
And again there was that warning look.
Come on, Galet, he thought. I'm not an idiot.
Fibbon knew better than to refer in any way to Robert or Athaclina. He shied away from even thinking about them. Still, he couldn't quite suppress a smile. So that was why the Quack-Who had been so polite. If Chims were waging intelligent war, and by the official rules at that, then all Chims had to be treated with some minimal degree of respect.
The mountain chimps survived that first day. They must have stung the invaders and kept stinging them.
He knew he was free to vent a bit of exultation. It would only be keeping in character. Galet's smile was thin. This news must have given rise to mixed feelings. After all, her own part of the insurrection had gone very much worse.
So, Fibbon thought. Uther Kalding's elaborate ruse persuaded the Gubru that there was something on the planet at least as important as the colony's value as hostage.
Garthlings. Imagine that. They went up into the mountains chasing a myth, and somehow the general found a way to hurt them as soon as they came within reach. Oh, I'm sorry for all those things I thought about her old man. What a great jape, Uther Kalding! But now the invaders are wise to it. I wonder if...
Fibbon glanced up and saw that Galet was watching him intently, as if gauging his very thoughts. At last Fibbon understood one of the reasons why she could not be completely open and frank with him.
We have to make a decision, he realized. Should we try to lie to the Gubru?
He and Galet might make the attempt. Try to prop up Uther Kalding's practical joke for just a while longer. They might succeed in convincing the suzerain just one more time to go off hunting mythical garthlings. It would be worth the effort if it drew even one more party of Gubru within reach of the mountain fighters. But did either he or Galet have anywhere near enough sophistication to pull off such a ruse? What would it take? He could just picture it.
Oh, yes, massa. There is Garthlands after all. Yes, boss. You can believe Brer Chim, yassa.
Or, alternatively, they could try reverse psychology.
Don't throw me in that briar patch.
Neither approach at all resembled the way Uther Kalding had done it, of course. The tricky Tim Brimmy had played a game of subtle colubrine misdirection. Fibbon did not even toy with the idea of trying to operate on so sophisticated a plane. And anyway, if he and Galet were caught trying to lie to the Gubru, it could very well disqualify the two of them from whatever special status the suzerain of propriety seemed to be offering this afternoon. Fibbon had no idea what the creature wanted of them, but it just might mean a chance to find out what the invaders were building out there by the Sea of Silmar. That could be vital information. No, it just wasn't worth the risk, Fibbon decided. Now he faced another problem, how to communicate these thoughts to Galen.
Even the most sophisticated Sophant race can make mistakes, he said slowly, enunciating carefully. Especially when they are on a strange world.
Pretending to look for a flea, he shaped the baby talk sign for,
Game finished now?
Obviously, Galen agreed. She nodded firmly.
The mistake is over now. They're sure Garthlings are a myth. The Gubru are convinced it was just a Timbrimi trap. Anyway, I get an impression the other suzerains, the ones that share command with the High Priest, won't allow any more pointless forays into the mountains, where they can be pot-shotted by gorillas.
Fibbon's head jerked up. His heart pounded for a few quick moments. Then it came to him what Galet had meant. How the last word she had spoken was intended to be spelled. Homonyms were one of the many awkward drawbacks modern Anglic had inherited from old-style English, Chinese, and Japanese. While galactic languages had been carefully designed to maximize information content and eliminate ambiguity, wolfling tongues had evolved rough and wild, with lots of idiosyncrasies, such as words with identical sounds, but different meanings. Fibbon found his fists had clenched. He forced himself to relax.
Gorillas, not gorillas. She doesn't know about the clandestine uplift project in the mountains,
Fibbon reassured himself.
She has no idea how ironic her remark sounded.
One more reason, though, to end Utha Calding's joke once and for all. The Timbrimi could not have been any more aware of the Howlett Center than his daughter. Had he known about the secret work there, Utha Calding would certainly have chosen a different ruse, not one meant to send the Gubru into those very same mountains.
The Gubru must not go back into the Mulan,
Fibbon realized.
It's only luck they haven't already discovered the Rillas. Stupid birds,
he muttered, playing to Galet's line.
Imagine them falling for a dumb wolfling folktale. After Garthlings, what'll they go after next? Peter Pan?
Superficially, Galet's expression was reproving.
You must try to be more respectful, Fibbon.
Underneath, though, he felt a strong current of approval. They might not have the same reasons, but they were in agreement this far. Utha Calding's joke was over.
What they're going after next, Fibbon, is us.
He blinked.
Us?
She nodded.
I'm guessing the war isn't going very well for the Gubru. Certainly they haven't found the dolphin ship that everyone's chasing over on the other side of the galaxy. And taking Garth hostage doesn't seem to have budged Earth or the Timbrimi. I'll bet it only stiffened the resistance and gained Terra some sympathy among former neutrals.
Fibbon frowned. It had been so long since he had thought about the larger scope, about the turmoil raging all across the five galaxies, about the Streaker, about the siege of Terra. Just how much did Galet know, and how much was mere speculation? In the nearby weather wall, a big black bird with a huge gaily colored bill was depicted landing in a rustle very close to the carpet where Fibbon and Galet sat. It stepped forward and seemed to regard Fibbon, first with one eye, then the other. The toucan reminded him of the suzerain of propriety. Fibbon shivered.
Anyway, Galet went on, the Enterprise here on Garth seems to be a drain on their resources that the Gubru can't afford too well, and the Institute for Civilized Warfare makes them give the planet back in only a few decades or so. I figure they're looking real hard for some way to make a profit out of all this.
Fibbon had an inspiration.
All that construction by South Point is part of that, right? It's part of the suzerain's plan to save his hash.
Galet's lips pursed.
Colorfully put, have you figured out what it is they're building?
The multicolored bird on the branch cawed sharply and seemed to be laughing at Fibbon. But when he glanced sharply that way, it had already returned to the serious business of picking through the imaginary detritus on the forest floor. Fibbon looked back at Galet.
"You tell me," he said.
"I'm not sure I can remember well enough to translate what the suzerain said. I was pretty nervous, you'll remember."
Her eyes closed for a moment.
Would a hyperspace shunt mean anything to you?"
The bird in the wall took off in an explosion of feathers and leaves as Fibbon leaped to his feet, backing more than a meter away. He stared down at Galet in disbelief.
"A what? But that's crazy! Build a shunt on the surface of a planet? It's just not..."
Then he stopped, remembering the great marble bowl, the mammoth power plants. Fibbon's lips quivered, and his hands came together, pulling on opposite thumbs. In this way, Fibbon reminded himself that he was officially almost the equal of a man, that he should be able to think like one when facing such incredible improbability.
"What?"
he whispered, licked his lips, and concentrated on the words.
"What's it for?"
"I'm not so clear on that," Galet said. He could barely hear her over the squawking from the make-believe forest.
Her finger traced a hand sign on the carpet, one which stood for confusion.
"I think it was originally intended for some ceremony, if they were ever able to find and claim Garthlings. Now the suzerain needs something to salvage out of their investment, probably another use for the shunt. If I understood the Gubru leader, Fibbon, it wants to use the shunt for us."
Fibbon sat down again. For a long moment they did not look at each other. There were only the amplified jungle sounds, the colors of luminescent fog flowing in between the leaves of a holographic rainforest, and the inaudible murmur of their own uncertain fear. The facsimile of a bright bird watched them for a little while longer from a replicant branch high overhead. When the ghostly fog turned to insubstantial rain, however, it finally spread fictitious wings and flew away. Chapter 60 Uthukalding. The Thenanin was obdurate. There did not seem to be any way to get through to him. Kalt seemed almost a stereotype, a caricature of his race. Bluff, open, honorable to a fault, and so trusting that it threatened to drive Uthukalding into fits of frustration. The glyph, Tivnus, was incapable of expressing Uthukalding's bafflement. Over the last few days, something stronger had begun taking shape in the tendrils of his corona, something pungent and reminiscent of human metaphor. Uthukalding realized he was starting to get pissed off. Just what would it take to raise Kalt's suspicions? Uthukalding wondered if he should pretend to talk in his sleep, muttering dire hints and confessions. Would that raise an inkling under the Thenanin's thick skull? Or maybe he should abandon all subtlety and write out the entire scenario, leaving the unfolded pages in the open for Kalt to find.
"Individuals can vary widely within a species,"
Uthukalding knew. And Kalt was an anomaly, even for a Thenanin. It would probably never occur to the fellow to spy on his Timbrimi companion. Uthukalding found it hard to understand how Kalt could have made it this far in the diplomatic corps of any race. Fortunately, the darker aspects of the Thenanin nature were not also exaggerated in him. Members of Kalt's faction, it seemed, weren't quite as smugly sanctimonious or utterly convinced of their own righteousness as those currently in charge of clan policy. More the pity, then, that one side effect of Utha Kalding's planned jest, if it ever succeeded, would be to weaken that moderate wing even more. Regrettable, but it would take a miracle to ever bring Kalt's group into power anyway, Utha Kalding reminded himself. Anyway, the way things were heading, he was going to be spared the moral quandary of worrying about the consequences of his practical joke. At the moment, it was getting exactly nowhere. So far, this had been a most frustrating journey. The only compensation was that this was not, after all, a Gubru detention camp. They were in the low rolling countryside, leading inexorably upward toward the southern slopes of the mountains of Mulun. The variety-starved ecosystem of the plains was giving way gradually to somewhat less monotonous scenery. Scrub trees and eroded terraces, whose reddish and tan sedimentary layers glittered with the morning light, winking as if in secret knowledge of long-departed days. As the wanderer's trek brought them ever closer to the mountains, Utha Kalding kept adjusting their path, guided by a certain blue twinkle on the horizon, a glimmer so faint that his eyes could barely make it out at times. He knew for a fact that Kalt's visual apparatus could not detect the spark at all. It had been planned that way. Faithfully following the intermittent glow, Utha Kalding had led the way and kept a careful watch for the telltale clues. Every time he spotted one, Utha Kalding went through the motions, dutifully rubbing out traces in the dirt, surreptitiously throwing away stone tools, making furtive notes, and hiding them quickly when his fellow refugee appeared around the bend. By now, anyone else would be positively seething with curiosity. But not Kalt. No, not Kalt. Just this morning, it had been the Thenanin's turn to lead. Their route took them along the edge of a mudflat, still damp from the recent onset of autumn rains. There, crossing their path in plain sight, had been a trail of footprints no more than a few hours old, obviously laid by something shuffling on two legs and a knuckle. But Kalt just strode on past, sniffing the air with those great breathing slits of his, commenting in his booming voice on how fresh the day felt. Utha Kalding consoled himself that this part of his scheme had always been a long shot anyway. Maybe his plan just wasn't meant to come about.
"Perhaps I am simply not clever enough. Perhaps both Kalt's race and my own assigned their dullest types to duty on this back-of-the-arm planet."
Even among humans, there were those who certainly would have been able to come up with something better. One of those legendary agents of the Terrigan's Council, for instance. Of course, there were no agents or other more imaginative Tim Brimmy here on Garth when the crisis hit. He had been forced to come up with the best plan he could. Utha Kalding wondered about the other half of his jest. It was clear the Gubru had fallen for his ruse. But how deeply? How much trouble and expense had it cost them? More importantly, from the point of view of a galactic diplomat, how badly had they been embarrassed? If the Gubru had proved as dense and slow as Kalt.
"But no, the Gubru are reliable," Utha Kalding reassured himself. "The Gubru, at least, are quite proficient at deceit and hypocrisy."
It made them easier enemies than the Thenanin. He shaded his eyes, contemplating how the morning had aged. The air was getting warm. There was a swishing sound, the crackle of breaking foliage. Kalt strode into view a few meters back, grumbling a low marching tune and using a long stick to brush shrubs out of his path. Utha Kalding wondered,
"If our peoples are officially at war, why is it so hard for Kalt to notice that I am obviously hiding something from him?"
The big Thenanin grunted as he approached. "Colleague, why have we stopped?" The words were in Anglic. Recently, they had made a game of using a different language every day for practice. Uther Kaldane gestured skyward.
"It is almost midday, Kalt. Gemulhai is getting fierce. We had better find a place to get out of the sun."
Kalt's leathery ridge crest puffed.
"Get out of the sun? But we are not in."
"Oh, ha, ha, ha. A wolfling figure of speech, very droll. Yes, Uther Kaldane. When Gemulhai reaches zenith, it might indeed feel somewhat as if we were roasting in its outer shell. Let us find shelter."
A small stand of brushy trees stood atop a hillock not far away. This time Kalt led, swinging his homemade staff, to clear a path through the tall, grassy growth. By now they were well practiced at the routine. Kalt did the heavy work of delving a comfortable niche down to where the soil was cool. Uther Kaldane's nimble hands tied the Thenanin's cape into place as a sunshade. They rested against their packs and waited out the hot middle part of the day. While Uther Kaldane dozed, Kalt spent the time entering data in his lap data well. He picked up twigs, berries, bits of dirt, rubbed them between his large, powerful fingers, and held the dust up to his scent slits before examining it with his small collection of instruments salvaged from the crashed yacht. The Thenanin's diligence was all the more frustrating to Uther Kaldane, since Kalt's serious investigations of the local ecosystem had somehow missed every single clue Uther Kaldane had thrown his way.
"Perhaps it is because they were thrown at him," Uther Kaldane pondered.
The Thenanin were a systematic folk. Possibly Kalt's worldview prevented him from seeing that which did not fit into the pattern that his careful studies revealed.
"An interesting thought."
Uther Kaldane's corona fashioned a glyph of appreciated surprise, as all at once he saw that the Thenanin approach might not be as cumbersome as he had thought. He had assumed that it was stupidity that made Kalt impervious to his fabricated clues.
But after all, the clues really are lies. My confederate out in the bush lays out hints for me to find and hide. When Kalt ignores them, could it be because his obstinate worldview is actually superior? In reality, he has proven almost impossible to fool."
True or not, it was an interesting idea. Seer Tunu riffled and tried to lift off, but Uther Kaldane's corona lay limp, too lazy to abet the glyph. Instead, his thoughts drifted to Athaclena. He knew his daughter still lived. To try to learn more would invite detection by the enemy's psi devices. Still, there was something in those traces, trembling undertones down in the Nahakiri levels of feeling, which told Uther Kaldane that he would have much new to learn about Athaclena, should they ever meet again in this world.
"In the end, there is a limit to the guidance of parents," a soft voice seemed to say to him as he drifted in half slumber. "Beyond that, a child's destiny is her own."
"And what of the strangers who enter her life?"
Uther Kaldane asked the glimmering figure of his long-dead wife, whose shape seemed to hover before him beyond his closed eyelids.
"Husband, what of them? They too will shape her, and she them. But our own time ebbs."
Her face was so clear. This was a dream such as humans were known to have, but which was rarer among Timrimi. It was visual, and meaning was conveyed in words rather than glyphs. A flux of emotion made his fingertips tremble. Methacluana's eyes separated, and her smile reminded him of that day in the capital when their coronae had first touched, stopping him, stunned and still in the middle of a crowded street. Half blinded by a glyph without any name, he had hunted the trace of her down alleyways, across bridges, and past dark cafes, seeking with growing desperation until, at last, he found her waiting for him on a bench, not 12 sistars from where he had first sensed her.
"You see?"
she asked in the dream voice of that long-ago girl.
"We are shaped. We change. But what we once were, that too remains always."
Uther Calding stirred. His wife's image rippled, then vanished in wavelets of rolling light.
"Sealtha,"
was the glyph that hovered in the space where she had been, standing for the joy of a puzzle not yet solved. He sighed and sat up, rubbing his eyes. For some reason, Uther Calding thought that the bright daylight might disperse the glyph. But Sealtha was more than a mere dream by now. Without any volition on his part, it rose and moved slowly away from Uther Calding toward his companion, the big Fenanin. Kalt sat with his back to Uther Calding, still absorbed in his studies, completely unaware as Sealtha transformed, changed subtly into Sealfquan. It settled slowly over Kalt's ridge crest, descended, settled in, and disappeared. Uther Calding stared, amazed as Kalt grunted and looked up. The Fenanin's breath slits wheezed as he put down his instruments and turned to face Uther Calding.
"There's something very strange here, colleague. Something I am at a loss to explain."
Uther Calding moistened his lips before answering.
"Do tell me what concerns you, esteemed ambassador."
Kalt's voice was a low rumble.
"There appears to be a creature, one that has been foraging in these berry patches not long ago. I have seen traces of its eating for some days now, Uther Calding. It is large, very large for a creature of Garth."
Uther Calding was still getting used to the idea that Sealfquan had penetrated where so many subtler and more powerful glyphs had failed.
"Indeed? Is this of significance?"
Kalt paused, as if uncertain whether to say more. The Fenanin finally sighed.
"My friend, it is most odd, but I must tell you that there should be no animal, since the Burrali Holocaust, able to reach so high into these bushes, and its manner of foraging is quite extraordinary."
"Extraordinary in what way?"
Kalt's crest inflated in short puffs, indicating confusion.
"I ask that you do not laugh at me, colleague."
"Laugh at you? Never!"
Uther Calding lied.
"Then I shall tell you. By now I am convinced that this creature has hands, Uther Calding. I am sure of it."
Uther Calding commented noncommittally. The Fenanin's voice dropped even lower.
"There is a mystery here, colleague. There is something very odd going on here on Garth."
Uther Calding suppressed his corona. He extinguished all facial expression. Now he understood why it had been Sealfquan, the glyph of anticipation of a practical joke fulfilled, that penetrated where none had succeeded before.
"The joke was on me!"